Greetings, friends, and welcome to the Decaledge podcast, a companion to the Decaledge blog. I'm Matt Boutte, your author and host. My guest today is Sophronia Scott. Sophronia is a novelist, essayist, and leading contemplative thinker whose work has appeared in numerous publications and received a 2020 Artist Fellowship grant from the Connecticut Office of the Arts. Her book, The Seeker and the Monk, Everyday Conversations with Thomas Merton, received the 2021 Thomas Merton Louis Award from the International Thomas Merton Society. She's the founding director of Alma College's Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, a low residency graduate program based in Alma, Michigan. This was an engaging conversation full of writing, faith, books, and vocation. I'm grateful to Sophronia for having it with me, and as always, I'm grateful to you, our listeners and readers. And now, please enjoy my conversation with Sophronia Scott. Sophronia Scott, welcome to the Decaledge podcast.
Thank you for having me, Matthew. Glad to be here.
I'm delighted that we could find an opportunity, a time to make it work. Lots of things I want to talk about today. I'm really fascinated by your work, really came to your work through your most recent book, The Seeker and the Monk. And so want to talk about that. But let's begin at the beginning, Sophronia. How did you grow up and where did you grow up? And how did that make you the person you are today?
That's a big question, Matthew.
It is a big question.
I grew up in Lorain, Ohio, which is just west of Cleveland. And most people, if you are literary, know it as the hometown of Toni Morrison.
Sure.
So I did not know her when I lived there, but I went to high school with her nieces and nephews. So I grew up in a family where my father didn't know how to read. He was a steel worker. I had six siblings in a very small house. So reading was kind of like my escape. And I started writing when I was a child. So I know it's unusual that I should be in such a household, and yet reading and writing became my thing.
So let me ask you, where were you getting books and what kind of books were you reading growing up?
My mom, we went to the library. My mom would make sure we went to the library. And of course, I would bring home stacks and stacks of books, right? So when I was younger, I loved just reading any kind of story. But I will say, and I remember this very clearly, when I was 9 years old, my fourth grade teacher gave me my first novel to read. She said I was ready to go to start reading books that did not have pictures, essentially, right? And I actually bought that book recently. I found it on Amazon because everything is on Amazon.
Right.
It's a book called By the Highway Home. And that was my first novel. And I was taken by how I didn't need pictures because I could see the whole story in my head.
That's amazing. That book must have really grabbed your attention, had an impact on you to be able to not only recall that it was your first book, but or rather your first novel, but to come to it later in life and say, it was such a touchstone. I need that in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't let go of these things. I still own the first books that I bought with my own money from like Scholastic Book Fair.
Yeah.
One of them was a novelization of the Bionic Woman story, Jamie Summers, who I loved.
That's so great.
And these five books, I have them now on my bookshelf, but I'm not supposed to have them. Because when I was a kid, when I was about 11 years old, there was a fire in our house. And my father, being extremely superstitious, we were not supposed to keep anything that had been burned.
Oh, wow.
And these books are singed. You see a couple of them don't have covers because they were burned off. But I took these books and I hid them.
Yeah, that's
amazing. And have kept them with me all these years.
That's amazing. What do you think motivated your mom to take you to the library?
Maybe she wanted to get rid of us. But yeah, no, that's, delete that's some reason. Children, delete some children, right? but also, you know, she was very aware of, you know, she would be the one to go to the teachers' conferences. You know, my father did not attend those.
Sure.
So, you know, she was very aware of our education, and I was reading very early on, and my teachers continued to encourage that. And so my mom just always made sure that we had books in our lives.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then you said you began writing as a child as well. What were you writing and why?
I first started in second grade copying out the words of a book about a girl and her doll. And I even drew the picture. So I was like, you know, sort of creating my own thing there. I was writing poetry, right, before I even understood what that was. But yeah, that's what I was. And I just responded to things. I would write things down. And it was just such a natural part of who I was that I didn't have a concept that that's what I was doing, that I was a writer. Like, I didn't have a concept of what that was until, you know, much, much later in my life.
And then, so books and writing are an ever-present part of your life as you grow up. You go into high school. What is life like for you?
Well, I first read Jane Eyre when I was 13. And that just blew the lid off of everything for me, because Jane Eyre, a book that's still influential to me now, Jane Eyre taught me how to think. That one could have agency in one's life, because here you have a character who has no placing in society. She has no money, no parents, and she thinks her way through. How do I get out of this situation and do something else? And there is a long, there's a long section in that book where she is at Lowood School trying to figure out, how do I get another position? How do I leave this place? Because I do not want to be here anymore. And that was just, I realized I can do that too, right? So that was enlightening to me. But in terms of the high school experience, you know, it wasn't always great, because, you know, I was the nerd, and it wasn't always a happy experience. And I was just geared towards, okay, I need to get out of here and go to college. Somehow I just knew college would be better.
In your book, Love's Long Line, a lot of that comes out, that parallel between your life and Jane Eyre, and not being in a situation that you would like, right? But looking ahead, not really knowing what the future looks like, but looking ahead to the future.
And right.
And that, I think, served you well, right? You went to a pretty good college.
I went to Harvard, which was awesome. I felt like I was revving my engine for that experience for a very long time. I was, you know, looking forward to meeting new people, and I was open, just so happy to be there and so open to anything. And I just soaked everything up like a sponge, but mostly it was my friends, like the people I met. I'm still very much connected to my Harvard classmates now, because my classmates taught me what is possible. Right, to truly live that agency in the world, to have a voice in the world. In fact, tonight I'm going to a play that my best friend in freshman year wrote this evening. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's exciting.
And so, what did you go to college to study?
Medicine.
Medicine.
Yeah. Pre-med. I was pre-med. Studied biology for a couple of years, because to me it was about, I needed to get into a profession where I knew I could take care of myself, right? Because my parents didn't have money, and I had an interest in doctors and medicine, but mainly because of TV, right? I watched Medical Center a lot when I was a kid, right? And I just thought it was something that I could do well, and was not happy doing it. Was really, you know, I'm not a science or math person. So I struggled, but I was also taking writing classes, and I was also taking English classes, which is ridiculous considering my schedule mix. But I something told me that if I kept writing, even though I had no idea what writing could be in my life, I just knew that something would change. And sure enough, one of my teachers said to me, "What are you doing? Don't you realize you're good enough to get paid for this?" And I was like, "What? Where? How? Tell me." Yeah,
just the kind of encouragement I need.
Yeah, point me in that direction, right?
Right.
And yeah, and he helped me meet a recruiter from Time Magazine, which some people may find interesting, the fact that Time Magazine did not recruit from journalism schools. They recruited from writing programs.
Interesting.
Right. So that's how they found me. And I was hired right out of college. And I started off in the research department there at Time Magazine.
Why do you think that was their preference?
Because writing was a huge and difficult thing at Time Magazine, at any of the Time Inc. magazines at the time. You had journalists in the field. And I mean, there was a group journalism, right? So a lot of people don't know that about Time Inc. There were multiple bylines on a story because you had multiple correspondents in the field filing stories. And you had a person in New York City who took all of this material and actually wrote the piece, right? So, writing that Time Inc. style, voice, putting together a story is a writing thing, not necessarily a journalistic thing. So,
sure.
So I think that's what their instinct was.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so because of that, you've been able to write professionally in some form or fashion really since you left college, right?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I left that realm in 2003 because in that journey, I started thinking about what do I want to write? Like, what is my voice that is not the Time voice? And so that exploration, you know, took me into the place where I'm writing these books now.
And so if you think back to that time where you began thinking about what do I want to write, what were you thinking then? Because as I look at your body of work, it has changed over time, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And even what I was thinking about then isn't what I thought I was going to write. I thought I was going to write more like journalistic nonfiction books back then.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then your body of work at this point is a combination of some novels, lots of essays, collections of essays, some nonfiction work.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about all of that today? How are you thinking about, let me ask the question differently. What type of work excites you today?
Well, I'm a writer, right? So sure. I when I went to earn my MFA, I thought I was going there to study fiction because I thought I had done the nonfiction thing as a journalist. But being in that program, I met people who showed me that nonfiction could go beyond journalism.
Sure.
And that I had important things to say in that realm. So I got a dual MFA degree in both fiction and creative nonfiction. And that experience taught me that I'm not a fiction writer. I'm not a nonfiction writer. I'm a writer. And I use whatever genre will best communicate the thing that I'm trying to relate. And sometimes that's fiction, right? Because sometimes it's the medicine goes down easier when you're telling a story, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I tend to just go back and forth between the two.
There's a line in your book, Love's Long Line, that I want to read and get your reaction to. It seems to me that vocation isn't a matter of what you can do or even what you're supposed to do. It's about what you were drawn to because it is who you are. So much so that to be in your true vocation is to find wholeness because your vocation is you, right down to the depths of your soul. So listeners to this podcast know I love the word vocation and all that it embodies. And so I'm curious, hearing your words read back to you, how you think about your vocation and how that passage maybe resonates with you now.
Well, it's interesting because I was just talking about this just a couple of weeks ago because I do these morning walk videos. And I was recently talking about vocation and how we think too much of work as something that we do, when really vocation and our work to me, it's about how do you want to be in the world, right? Who are you as a person? How do you want to be? And what work is going to help you be that, right? So when I hear those words, I hear an affirmation of that, because I what I put on the page is me, right? I met with a book club last night, and they just read Love's Long Line, and they were talking about how I could be so vulnerable and personal, and well, that's an expression of wholeness, right? I don't split myself to this in this way that's like, okay, well, I'm secretive in a certain way or not wholly there on the page, right? So me as a writer is about this thing that I am as a person. I seem to take things in. I listen really well. I observe the world in a certain way, and I'm just sharing what is for me, right? So it's almost indescribable. It's like, okay, this is who I am.
But do you also agree that posture, that authenticity, that identification with your vocation is somewhat unusual?
I guess so. Well, I guess, yeah, so, because, because we don't think, that sometimes people are really scared of that word vocation.
They are.
Right?
Yes.
So just in the fact that we are discussing this already puts us outside of a certain realm.
Right. Yeah.
And we also, if we were to have this conversation elsewhere, what would be the first thing that would come up? Money.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So some people would be saying that I'm being naive, but on the other hand, I have been without money many times in my life. Right? And one way or the other, things work out. But at the end of the day, I think about Zora Neale Hurston and how she died alone and in poverty, and yet still writing, and still sending ideas for books, still doing the thing that she was meant to do. And I think on a certain level, we have to be willing to live that way, to be afraid, to not be afraid of letting it all hang out there, to take that risk.
I think that's right. But I also think it's you're getting at what frightens most people of the idea of vocation, that I may be called to a vocation that is outside of societal norms, that I don't make any money, that I live like a starving artist or a pauper. Like that frightens people.
Yeah.
And identifying your vocation is hard work and requires you to be vulnerable with yourself, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think we even make that harder than it really is, because there are things that we are naturally drawn to, right? That we think, well, that can't possibly be a vocation. I enjoy that.
Right.
Work is supposed to be hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And yet we suffer enough just in regular existence, just in being in these human bodies that are going to deteriorate, right? Why add to that by thinking that we have to go against our strengths and go against our natural proclivities that has the possibility of not only raising us up, but raising up others? Because at the end of the day, vocation is not just about us, right?
That's right.
It's about what we are bringing to the world that can change the world and in turn help others, right, bring their light out into the world.
I think that's right. I love that. Tell me about your writing process. What does that look like for you when you're working on something?
It usually starts with an idea. Here's a story I want to tell. Here's here's something I want to explore. And I usually have a thought of what the basic structure of what that essay or story or novel might be. So then I enter into the writing of it. And there is a process of exploration of letting the story become what it needs to be, right? Of letting the characters grow. If it's nonfiction, it's about discovering what I'm learning about myself and recognizing where I'm having difficulties, asking hard questions of myself, and seeing what comes out from that. But being willing to go down the tough roads. So I talk about the example of the essay in Love's Long Line, the essay for Annie Pearl, which started out as I just wanted to tell the story, which I thought was kind of funny, of me searching for a used fur coat for this elderly woman in Lorain, Ohio, who lived in Lorain, Ohio. But in writing that, I have to ask myself, well, it's not just a funny story. Why was I so taken with this? So taken with it that I want to write about it years after the fact.
Right.
There has to be something in the present that is drawing me to this. And that brought me to some not so nice things I realized I felt about my mom.
Right.
And that was a shock to me. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm writing about my mom. And not only my mom, I'm writing about my sister's death. And I have to go down that road.
Right. Yeah. It's a funny story, but it's a vulnerable, honest piece of work. Do you write every day?
No, I'm not a writer like that. I try to journal every few days, but I'm a project-oriented writer. So for example, right now I am getting ready to work on an essay about a kiln firing at a huge wood-fired kiln in Collegeville, Minnesota. And right now, that's about reading. So right now, I'm reading about the process. I'm reading about the studio. Soon, I'm going to be interviewing artists who will be bringing work to the kiln. And at some point, I'll be taking notes. And at some point, then I will be writing that essay. Right? So
how do you avoid the temptation, and maybe you're not tempted this way, but how do you avoid the temptation to procrastinate the writing by continuing to do reading and research?
That's not in my wheelhouse because of my training at Time Magazine, right? Because at the end of, there's a point where you have to stop and write the article, right? So that is that I kind of know when I have what I need. I also know when I'm stuck and I realize I'm missing some information. So I know when to go back to it. But I also had a helpful piece of information years ago. I went to hear Edward P. Jones, the writer, at a Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the gnome world. And I asked him about research. I asked him this question. And he was someone who would go deeply into the research. And he said that only about a quarter of all the research that he did for the gnome world, only about a quarter of it is in that book. And he said that he had to stop himself and realize that he was not writing a book about the way the latches on the slave quarters worked. I'm writing a story about people.
Right.
Right. So he knew that had to come first. And that the research had to serve that story.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
When you write, perhaps at the beginning or throughout, do you like pen and paper, pencil and paper? Do you work on the computer? How do you do that?
A lot of times when I'm working on nonfiction, I'll be on the computer. But with fiction and also some nonfiction, I write a lot by hand. I've tried not to, because it really does take a long time to, because I will write pages and pages and then I got to type it into the computer. And, I've been thinking about maybe getting a Remarkable, like to see if that, doing that a handwriting tablet will work.
Sure.
But it's something about the pen and the paper. And I have notebooks, right? I have all sorts of notebooks. I just have to do that. I feel like my writing sounds more authentic when I write it by hand. I hear it better.
Are you particular about pens and paper, or anything at hand will do?
No, it has to be good paper. Although if I'm stuck, right, of course I'll write on the back of something. But sure. But I'm a gel pen person. You know, okay. I write with the Uniball.
Yeah.
You know, and these are good for signing books too. So, so I like the flow of that ink.
I love it.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I'd like to talk about the seeker and the monk. Sophronia, who is Thomas and how have you come to know him?
Thomas is Thomas Merton. And other people know him as Father Louis. And he, you know, probably went by Tom. But for me, when I learned about him and when I started reading his journals, he became Thomas to me. And I first heard his words in a lecture when I started as an MFA student, and one of the lecturers quoted him, and I heard his words and it just blew my mind. I was like, oh my, who is that? What is that? You know, he sounds like he thinks the way I think, and there is something about God that he absolutely understands, and I have to find out more about this guy. And that eventually led me to his journals, which was where I really, you know, he has 7 volumes of journals. And to me, reading someone's journal is like reading letters to a friend, right? So I sure. deeply connected with him through his journals.
And so in that context, tell me about the book. Who did you write The Seeker and the Monk for? And what do you want readers to take away from it?
Well, Matthew, it wasn't a book I planned to write, right? You know, Thomas Merton, as you know, was hugely prolific, and lots of people write about Thomas Merton.
Sure.
And so I did not see that the world needed another Thomas Merton book. I was just happy in what I was reading. But I attended I was asked to be on a panel about Merton at the Festival of Faith and Writing, and this was in 2018, the spring of 2018. And I told the audience right up front, I said, look, you have to know, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a Merton scholar. I'm not a theologian. I just kind of have this monk who follows me around and gives me advice. So I'm going to talk to you about Merton in that way. This is just how I read Merton. And it surprised me that that struck a note for people, and that they would come up to me asking me about it and talking about it. And I began to realize that I guess people needed a way to connect with Merton, that whatever is available now wasn't doing it for them. And finally, a woman at the festival came up to me and said, and you're writing your Merton book too, aren't you? And at the light bulb moment, yes, I am. Because suddenly I could see what it was. I could see what it was, and I could see the need for it. I could hear the question that was being answered. And that's what I do. I like to answer questions in my writing. A lot of my essays are about answering questions that people seem to have. And so that's what that book was about. It's about, okay, here's how I read Merton. And maybe this will help you into Merton so that you can read him in your way as well.
There's, speaking of answering questions, there's a question in this book that I'm curious. The question resonated with me, and it is it possible to be ambitious and humble? Hmm. And just curious if you could expand on that a little.
Well, because Merton struggled with that, right? Because he was a writer to the nth degree and wanted so much to be out there as a writer. And yet his whole vocation was as a priest and as a monk and being humble. And he was almost like a split personality. He even says, you know, he's Father Louis, but this Thomas Merton has followed me into the monastery. And he whispers marketing ideas to me while I'm supposed to be at prayer. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it does seem like one shouldn't be able to exist without, you know, with the other. Like it doesn't seem that way. And yet I feel that we should want to be good at the thing that the gift that God has given us. And maybe the humble aspect comes in knowing that what we do and what we have is not really ours, right? We are merely exercising the hoping to make use of what has been given to us. I tend to watch Chariots of Fire a lot, and it's been on cable again recently. Eric Liddell is fascinating to me. You know, his sister is berating him. I'm all of this running, and I'm worried about what it's going to do to you, right? She thinks it is going to take him away from being humble and being a servant. But he's explaining to her that it would be wrong not to use this gift. God made me fast. God made me fast. And I feel God's pleasure when I run, right? But he's walking that line and knowing that if he does exercise his gift in a certain way, he is coming away from being humble. If he had run on the Sunday, you know, he tells him he won't run on the Sunday. But if he were to say, well, no, I want that medal, I'm going to run, right? Then he's not being humble anymore, is he? Right? The ambition there takes over. So.
Yeah. So as I understand it through your writing, you've, to borrow a phrase, come to faith somewhat later in your life than many people. Maybe your faith as you currently practice it wasn't that way as a child. So I guess I'm curious how your faith has influenced and changed your writing over time, and how it's influenced and changed you as a person over time.
Well, I will make a correction first. Okay. I did not come to faith late in life. I've been in faith since I was a child.
Okay.
But my faith has changed and matured, right? In my practice of faith. In the exploration that came of my family joining the Episcopal Church about 12 years ago now. So what has changed is that my writing has made it more outward facing. To me, my faith is my faith, and it's in me. And I would not have thought anyone had any interest in my faith. And I, you know, only spoke about it with people very close to me, and I'm very aware that not everyone practices or understands it. So why would I even think to write about it? But again, the friend I had at the MFA program who encouraged me to write nonfiction, we would talk about faith, we would correspond about it, and he encouraged me. He said that there people would want to hear about faith the way I saw it. And when I started to do it, the response I received, and I hear this regularly, people tell me that I have somehow put words to a feeling that they have that they did not have words for.
Mm, yeah.
Right. So again, to me, that's a particular gift.
And I agree.
And it would be wrong of me to not practice that gift.
I agree. And thank you for sharing that gift. It's important. I want to go back to the seeker and the monk for a moment. There's a passage in it that echoes some of our earlier conversations about vocation and authenticity. What you write is, when I think of how Merton connected with his soul friends, the key seemed to be showing up somewhere and being totally, unreservedly himself, like laying all of his cards on the table. I think that speaks to some of the things we were talking about earlier. And then later in the book, you write, betrayals, to me anyway, are about people who are supposed to know you. They intentionally put you in a place of having to be something other than yourself. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could expand on that just a little bit.
There's, I'm trying to think of a particular instance, it's difficult. So you are one way in the world, right? If you are whole and you are within yourself, right? And yet if you have someone in your life, whether through your work or friends, put you in a situation of, for example, dragging you to do, like, if you don't drink, for example, let's say that, right? You don't drink, but you are in a group of people and you have a friend who is uncomfortable. You know, people around you will be uncomfortable because you don't drink. And I've never been a drinker, never. I've tried to drink. I just don't like the taste of alcohol. And yet I've been in circles where people will try to, you have to drink. But that's not who I am. And why should I change that about myself? Because you feel this greater need to feel comfortable about it yourself. Right. So that's why would I want to spend more time with a person who is essentially saying that? Like, my comfort is much more important than who you are. Right.
Yeah. And drinking is one thing, but it can happen at a much deeper emotional, spiritual level, and that's where it's really problematic.
Exactly. And we don't recognize when we do that, right? That there are many ways when we play out that type of scenario in other areas, right? Kind of like the scene in Chariots of Fire, where he's sitting with the Prince of Wales and the Olympic Committee, and they are trying to convince him that he has to run on Sunday. And they were telling him, well, for me, in my time, it was always king and country first and God later, right? Yeah. And he takes issue. He's like saying, you don't even know what you're asking of me, right? That this is my belief. And one of the men on the committee says eventually, he's like, I'm glad that that this changed and that we didn't have to force him to do this, because his running is an extension of his life force, of his faith energy. And it is not worth anything to divide a person from that, right? That guy, that character recognized that.
This conversation is important to me because when I read the passage, I think naturally my thought was how other people are betraying who I am. But as we talk about it, it makes me wonder, who am I doing that to? Which is maybe a more important question.
Yeah.
As a friend, as a husband, as a parent, something to think about.
Yeah. Especially as a parent.
Yeah.
Right? Because how many times are we wanting our children to live some expectation that we have, either because we think it's going to make them safer or because this is what we want to be able to brag about, right? whatever, right? But they have their own journeys. And there's a constant process, for me anyway, of being aware of what my son's journey is and letting him walk that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I think you have another book, a new book coming out next spring. You want to tell me about that book?
Yeah, it's my next novel. It's historical fiction, comes out March 1st. It's called Wild, Beautiful, and Free. And it is historical fiction about a mixed race girl born to a sharecropper, a plantation owner and a slave. But her mother dies in childbirth and the plantation owner raises her as his daughter. But when he dies, his resentful wife sells her into slavery. And so the story is about her finding her way in the world, trying to get away from slavery, but also in this mixed race world. And this is right before the Civil War, right? How does she find a place in the world where she has none? Right. She's mixed race. She has no family. She has to live essentially by her own wits. But she also has a strong sense of her father's love. She knows that her, she knows that her father loved her. She has a strong sense of faith, and she's trying to make her way in the world with purpose and knowing that she is a worthy person.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Tell me about your work at Alma College.
Oh, goodness, Matthew. You know, it was work that I did not expect to do.
Okay.
And I was actually just texting this morning with my friend Heather, who lives in New York City. 2 years ago, in January of 2020, we were walking through Central Park in New York City, talking about, as we usually do, we talk about the publishing industry and issues in it, such as diversity. And, you know, why is this such a problem? Why can't it be solved? And we came up with the thought that, well, maybe it starts with the feeder system. Maybe it starts with the MFA programs. And it seems like MFAs are always trying to catch up with diversity. And then we were thinking, you know, wow. And I said, maybe we just have to start one from scratch. And I kid you not, just a few days later, I get a email from a friend who works at Alma College that said, we are starting an MFA program. It's just been approved. They're looking for a director, and I think you should do it.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, well, maybe I am supposed to be doing this. Okay. So I decided, well, I can at least start the interview process. Sure. If I'm not supposed to do it, then I won't get the job and I'm no worse off.
Right.
But I did get it. And so it's been an amazing journey to think about what this program can be and what it is and the students to bring to it. I've assembled a fantastic faculty, and I love the energy about it. People coming to Michigan twice a year and then working one-on-one with their faculty mentor after that to really focus on writing. Right, what they care about, what they have to say in the world. And I recently did a virtual open house. We do a schedule of virtual open houses every month. And one of my students was on the call to talk about the program. And to me, she gave the highest compliment when she said that when she was seeking programs and was looking for advice, one of her mentors had told her to apply to Alma, said, you know, I know it's a new program, but you will be treated as a human there, that you will not be just a number.
That's high praise.
And exactly. And she said, and she feels exactly that way. And we had our third residency just in June. And yeah, the energy was palpable. The excitement, both from the faculty and the students that, you know, and I'm just watching it all unfold and thinking, yeah, we have something hugely special here. You know, our placement in Michigan, in this beautiful state, in this community where people are excited to have this program housed at Alma, this is it. This is it. Now, all we have to do is let more people know that we are here and you know, have this energy continue.
That's terrific. Hopefully this podcast will help get that word out just a little bit.
No, thank you, Matthew.
Sophronia, tell me about the last book you read.
Well, actually, I'm finishing it right now. It is Erosion by Terry Tempest Williams.
That's a good book.
Essays of Undoing, right? And
yeah.
And Terry is fierce,
she right? is.
In her stewardship of the land. And it is striking and challenging to read this work. Right. So she's a beautiful writer and she's vulnerable as well. And she's a friend. We both actually spoke at Chautauqua the same week, just last month. And yeah, so I'm really enjoying this book. And before that, of course, yeah, still, even in my reading, I go back and forth with fiction and nonfiction. I finished, I read A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce.
Wow.
Just because, you know, this, it's been in the back of my mind, and I'm trying to read books that you know, I kind of should have read ages sure. ago, and I haven't. And I just had a fascination for the Stephen Dedalus character, and so, and also the faith. Faith is you know, in this book. So
yeah, that's great.
Just curious.
That's great. Thanks for sharing those.
Yeah.
Sophronia, where can people find out more about you and your work and keep up with all the great things you have going on?
Oh, my website is just my first name, sophronia.com. And I have an events page there, so you know where I am. For example, I will be in Italy in just 2 weeks because I teach a writer's retreat there every year in the Veneto region, you know, near Venice. And we go to Venice. So I'm excited that we're doing that again. It's been 3 years. So to be doing that annually is great. I also have a YouTube channel. And on social media, you can also find these videos. I do a morning walk video. It's only like, you know, a few minutes long. I try to do them every Friday, weather permitting, where I just go out and I'm walking and talking about what's on my mind. It's really simple.
I love it. Yeah. And Instagram as well?
Oh, yes. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Okay. Well, we'll be sure and link to all of those in the show notes so people can keep up with you.
Oh, thank you, Matthew.
Sophronia, thank you so much for your time today and for your authenticity and for your vulnerability and for your work. It really, really does matter.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Just a few quick things before you go. First, thank you so much for listening. It really does mean a lot to me. If you enjoy the show, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. Commenting on or rating the show would be great too. You can also go to the website, thedecaledge.com, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode or a blog post. And did you know the Decal Edge has an online bookstore? There's a link at the top of the website where you can find nearly all of the books that we review or discuss. Maybe most importantly, if you're enjoying the show, is to tell a friend about it. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do it through the contact page on the website. Special thanks to Taylor Weidman for producing the show, for the intro music, and even for designing the Decal Edge logo. I really couldn't do this without Taylor's help, and I'm grateful for his efforts. Want to experience more of Taylor's work? Check out his podcast, the Dharmadillo Podcast. That's it for now. We'll have another episode for you soon. Thanks, and God bless.